You're listening to Faith and Reason 360. Support for Faith and Reason 360 comes from the D.L. Dykes Jr. Foundation, promoting critical thinking about faith and life, and from listeners like you. By the way, I'm Debo Dykes.
And I'm Ann Phelps.
Many of you out there have read books by the late, great Marcus Borg. Books like Meeting Jesus Again for the First Time.
Or maybe The Heart of Christianity or The God We Never Knew or Reading the Bible Again for the First Time. For a lot of us who at some point in our journey abandoned Christianity and or the church, Marcus gave us permission to think critically about faith and an opportunity to reclaim that Christian heritage. When I was in college, I was in this kind of moment, and I encountered his book, Meeting Jesus Again for the First Time, in a historical Jesus class. And in that class, I was from rural Nebraska in a small liberal arts college there in the middle of the plains, and he came to the big city, which is Omaha, where I'm from. You know you're from somewhere small when
Omaha's big.
Exactly. And so we drove those 3 hours east, some of us who were in the class, to hear him speak. And not only did his words inspire me and comfort me, but I saw that there were others gathered listening to him and that I was not alone in this process of thinking critically about my faith and the inability to shut off the questions that I now believe God has put within me. He has been an incredibly liberating figure, and it's an honor to remember him today.
Oh, yes, yes. In 2013, Faith and Reason did a seminar at Christ Church Cathedral in Houston, Texas. It featured John Dominic Crossan, Sister Joan Chittister, and the late Marcus Borg. The seminar was titled, Does Christianity Have a Future? It was probably one of the most exciting seminars we'd ever done. It was standing room only, actually sitting room and standing room. People were literally sitting in front of the modesty rails at Christ Church Cathedral.
It sounds like an event not so dissimilar from the one I encountered in Omaha. And what strikes me about that question, that title of the seminar, Does Christianity Have a Future, is how relevant that question remains all these years later. And, you know, we've seen all the articles and the research from the Pew Forum that the rise of the nuns, right? Those in my generation who are leaving religion either out of just disinterest or having been wounded for so many reasons. And that question is really pressing, especially to a lot of my friends who have invested their education and become ordained and are leading churches as a profession. What is happening to this religion? Also to those of us who may or may not be ordained, but are invested in the justice legacy of Jesus. It's an interesting question, and so I'm excited to revisit it today and put it in the context of 2017.
Okay, great. We're going to be listening to different clips from Marcus' first presentation during that seminar, and he was asked the question, why am I still a Christian? And Marcus was a Christian, although many would say that he wasn't. So let's listen to Marcus's first statement. As a Christian, what he doesn't believe.
What I don't believe in. First, biblical infallibility or biblical inerrancy. Roughly half of American Protestants belong to churches that insist on this. And I think a lot of mainline Protestants, I'm not so sure about Catholics at this point, have the impression that basically the Bible is pretty much always right. Think of the revered way that we treat it in church. There's a reading from the lectionary, and the lector says, "The word of the Lord," no matter how terrible the text was. And then the congregation responds, "Thanks be to God." It's really important to recognize that sometimes the Bible is wrong. Flat out wrong. And not wrong because we've misinterpreted it. And if we've been clearer about that over the last half century, or if you wish, 17 centuries, we would not have had a lot of the fights that we've had in the church.
What Marcus shares with the audience here raises so many questions. Particularly, I think about many of those in my faith formation, my teenage years, who would really, really balk at his phrase, "The Bible is wrong."
Yeah.
That is a very bold claim. It was then, it is now. And I think it begs the question, can the Bible be sacred? Is it sacred to him? Because presumably he's going to go on and say he is still a Christian, given the title of this talk. Can the Bible be sacred? How can we engage this text if we believe that it is flawed in some way, or to use his word, flat out wrong?
Well, I think that a lot of folks would find Marcus's words shocking. Mm-hmm. But I have a very high regard for Marcus, and so I find his statement, his words, very comforting, because mm-hmm. there are a lot of sayings in the Bible that I just can't square with. Let's take, for example, Jesus tells Saul to kill every man, woman, child, and beast, and all of the enemy, beast of the enemy. I just never could reconcile that kind of God
with the
God that
entire,
shows up with Jesus.
Yeah, the entire books of Joshua and Judges are a real struggle to read.
Yeah.
It's about mass acts of genocide, and that doesn't sit well with me. And I know there are those who say that we're misinterpreting it. We must not understand it. But I do think there is a way. There are different ways that I have engaged in to keep these texts sacred and relevant, because they are sacred, right? They are set apart. They aren't just the newspaper. They are texts that I take to have valued truth within them because I am a Christian, while still having flaws. The Bible is not an instruction manual. I remember being told at Bible camp that Bible stands for Basic Instructions Before Leaving Earth. They sure like nonsensical acronyms at Bible camp. But
oh gosh.
But I really resist that now. I don't think the Bible is an instruction manual at all. If it is, we would all be stoning each other and killing our firstborn children and things like that. Instead, it is a narrative. It is the story of people who are seeking God, flawed and limited humans who are seeking God that is way beyond human comprehension. And so in this ancient world in which they're living and they're struggling to survive and they have enemies, they have an imperfect view of God just as we do now. They think they have all the answers, often as we do now, but they write with that confidence, and they tell their story as they saw it. And as time moves forward, not to offer chronological snobbery here, but as time moves forward, we learn more and more about God, and our circles of who is included in that love get broader and broader. And so while you can see those stories as evil stories of mass genocide, I think they also, if taken into the giant context of the whole biblical corpus, can be understood as guiding us. And so wrong, yes, they are. But I don't think what he means is that they aren't valuable and central to our identity as Christians.
Right. Obviously, there was something going on.
Right.
And so that was recorded.
Yes.
because there was obviously, and there was a lot of violence.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of God, I just really don't believe in a violent God. That maybe your little acronym should have been "while living on Earth."
Yes, exactly.
Leaving Earth.
Yes. Yes.
But you know, there's a lot of violence in the Old Testament, and you know, there's a lot of violence in the New Testament. I mean, Revelation is just probably the most violent piece of literature I think I've ever read.
Mm-hmm.
So when Marcus says some parts of the Bible are flat out wrong, I really can breathe a sigh of relief. I can relax, and I can see what the Bible really has to say, just as you were pointing out, because actually reading the Bible, the text, and paying attention to what the text says is something that Marcus invites us to do.
Absolutely. it also begs the question, you know, a lot of people who hear that phrase, the Bible is wrong, as he says, and you mentioned leading up to this, would lead many Christians to say he isn't one, which I think begs a second question. Who is the gatekeeper of this faith, of this tradition? And I, you know, I think you and I would both fall in that category as well. Yes. Often, I'm sure both of us have been told throughout the course of our journeys by someone or multiple someones that we also don't count. And I think one of the things I really value about what we're learning in the 21st century is that people have the opportunity to self-identify, right? You don't get to tell me if I am X, Y, or Z. That's up to me to say I am Ann Phelps, a woman from the Midwest who is a Christian. And I think that self-identity, you know, what is the church? Who is the authority to say who counts, who's in, who's out? And I have a pretty radical notion of the priesthood of all believers. I think we get to say. And as someone who identifies as a Christian, you don't get to tell me if I'm in or out. That's up to me. Marcus goes on to say something that many might think is very similar to what he just said about biblical inerrancy, but he separates these two categories. Hear his statement about biblical literalism.
Secondly, I don't believe in biblical literalism. It's not only mistaken, it's actually impossible, even for those who say they believe in it. What does it mean, for example, when a passage refers to trees clapping their hands, or mountains shouting with joy, or for that matter, the right hand of God? Does anybody imagine God has hands? Or when it speaks of God hearing our prayers, does anybody imagine that God has ears? Now, my point is, we understand what that language means. But we understand it precisely because we don't take it literally. And neither do biblical literalists. The faithful alternative is what I call historical-metaphorical interpretation. Something quite simple, even though it can take a long time to explain it, is meant. Historical interpretation simply means ancient text in ancient context. Metaphorical interpretation means emphasizing the more than literal meaning of the text, the surplus of meaning that language can carry.
I can remember as a child hearing these passages and asking questions like, okay, so let me see if I understand this. Joshua and the people paraded around the wall of Jericho, and they shouted and they blew horns and the walls came down. Mm-hmm. Now, how does that work?
Mm-hmm.
Something else must have happened.
Mm-hmm.
So even as a child, things didn't make sense to me that were in the Bible. Not only the walls coming down, you know, I always would wonder, oh, what happened to the people? I hope they ran and got away and no one was hurt from the falling stones.
Absolutely. I mean, I remember asking the question and getting in trouble for asking it, which was kind of my signature move in youth group. But asking the question, if Jesus speaks in parables, why can't God? And basically asking this question, right? Jesus was often using metaphor. The kingdom of God is like, and then would obviously it's a simile for those English majors listening, but it is metaphorical language. And if Jesus was doing that to help us understand things that are bigger than this world, why can't God do the same in telling God's story of creation and telling God's story of the great flood and the triumph of civilization over a deeply threatening nature, or which is also a troubling story we now know. But but I think that question of more than literal is what came out of those questions I was asking in youth group, right? How, if something is merely literal, if something happened once to this one person, if God spoke to Mary and said, you're going to have a baby and it's a miracle, cool for Mary.
Right.
But if God speaks to women everywhere and says, you can generate life. What a miracle. How much more meaning can we find in that story? If we allow all of these stories to be metaphors that we can all find meaning in all the time, whether it's miracles of birth or miracles of resurrection or miracles of creation, that metaphor for me, Borg goes on to say in part of the statement we didn't listen to, he goes on to talk about how it doesn't matter to him if certain things happen literally. And I was in that place for a while, but I'm actually not anymore. It does matter to me because if it's only literal, I find it incredibly limiting. If, for example, the resurrection is merely one thing that happened to one guy's body one day almost 2,000 years ago, then what difference does it make to me? But if it's more than that, it must be more than that. And so I'm no longer in that place where it doesn't matter to me. It, in fact, matters greatly to me that it isn't literal.
Well, and I love how Marcus said it's just impossible. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm very sensitive to people who are emphatic about the literalism of the Bible, mm-hmm. but if you pay close attention to it, it contradicts itself. Mm-hmm. And the other literal part of the Bible that I've always struggled with since I cannot remember when it started for me, probably the first time I ever heard it, a talking snake. That just never worked
Surely
for me.
Surely this is supposed to be mythical.
Yeah. I mean, it's a story.
Of the things I heard a lot, you know, was sort of the superseding of the Old Testament with the New Testament, and this idea that the truth of the law is superseded by the truth of Jesus. And so if Jesus came not to abolish the law but to fulfill it, we sort of ignore the Old Testament. It doesn't matter. And then we take the New Testament literally. But what I remember, again, getting in trouble for asking was, okay, but it's the New Testament that says that women should cover their heads in worship, and none of us do. And in fact, the church across town that does, we call them a cult. And so how do we reconcile that? And the way the pastor came to me with an answer was that it in that historical context, it mattered. And so as Borg says, it is impossible. The literalism is impossible. The question is, at what level do we engage it? And how aware are we that we are on a sliding scale of that literalism?
And considering that the Bible is not literal, it still serves a beautiful purpose. It still serves to raise people's awareness about others and our responsibility towards others. And it also helps us to be aware that these people living during this period of time, there was a great deal going on. Mm-hmm. And so the stories help tell the stories of that time. Mm-hmm. Also, the other part that I find difficulty when you were talking about the Old Testament and it being so violent, and then the New Testament, and then Jesus, the Beatitudes, which represents our awareness of more peaceful issues, kindness. But the other question I would ask, and it even relates to Marcus's first statement, is whether you're focused on the Old Testament or the New Testament, especially Revelations, I have to ask myself or ask others, and I believe Marcus says this, what is the nature of your God? Mm-hmm. So when someone approaches me and is just emphatic that the Bible is to be taken literally, and that would include the violence, then I have to look at these people and I have to wonder, your God is a violent God. Mm-hmm. And so thus the nature of your God contains violence. I can't go there.
Nope.
The nature of my God is one that wills goodness and wills the common good, so all goodness for all people everywhere at all times.
Absolutely.
And now let's listen to Marcus's third statement. This time he's going to be talking about the cross, and he's going to reference payment of the understanding of the cross.
A third thing I don't believe. What I call in shorthand the payment understanding of the cross. That notion that Jesus died to pay for our sins. I see that understanding as a pervasive and pernicious perversion, not only of the death of Jesus, but of the heart of the Christian gospel and message.
Marcus says it's pervasive and pernicious. Mm-hmm. And I absolutely agree that we're faced with a real problem mm-hmm. in Christianity today, because the most widely proclaimed and taught mm-hmm. idea of Christianity is that Jesus's crucifixion paid God for our sins, mm-hmm. paid God off mm-hmm. for our sins.
It's, as he says, I mean, absolutely pervasive. I hear that rhetoric and see the effects of that theology, many would call substitutionary atonement theology, pervading every tradition I've encountered. This isn't unique to one specific strand of evangelicalism or the Catholic Church or the mainline church. It is absolutely pervasive. And, you know, you have to wonder why that has taken off, right? We've delved into it before, where it came from, and you know, St. Anselm's original goals in it were noble, right? It was the original goals in generating this theology were to help interrupt the crusader mentality.
Well, and Anselm did that in 11th century.
Exactly. So over half of Christianity had no concept of this. But it was, you know, around this time, of course, years, centuries later, but we begin to emerge from the medieval church, and we begin to see the emergence of the Enlightenment and new institutions. And a part of that process, and it has its benefits, I'm not purely anti, but a part of that was capitalism. And capitalism now dominates the way we as human beings move through the world. And so a theology that is rooted in a capitalist story of payment, of course, is going to resonate with 21st century and 20th century people. It is how we move in everything we do. It dominates everything that we are doing. And so that makes sense, but we need to be aware of our own situatedness, just as he talks about the historical critical view in the ancient world and the ancient context. We live in a moment and we live in a context, and someday people will look back at the capitalist context and the capitalist moment and say they couldn't see beyond this story. It was the water in which we swim, and so it's difficult to critique. It's one of the hardest things to undermine when teaching theology to undergraduate students, for example, because it is understood not as a way to interpret the gospel, but as the gospel, right?
Yes.
We were created by God. We fell short. Someone needed to pay our ransom.
Yes.
God demanded a blood sacrifice, and the only sacrifice valuable enough was God's own child, because it needed to be of God, and only God could create something that perfect. And so God kills God's own child to satisfy this need. That is pervasive. And so to me...
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah.
I cannot go there with this. It's just my fundamental and our deepest problem with it's having to imagine that this plan of salvation described in the way that God describes it requires mm-hmm. A human being mm-hmm. be killed, murdered.
Absolutely. It and the question I get most frequently from the students who are able and prepared to engage this critique, and I think this is a great question and one worth exploring, is if that isn't the gospel, what is?
Love it. Love it.
What are your thoughts on that?
What is the gospel? Mm-hmm. Well, it's will come as no secret for mm-hmm. me that I think the gospel is what Jesus actually was about mm-hmm. when he was walking around on the planet, mm-hmm. walking around on the earth. He mm-hmm. was very aware of the needs of others. He was Absolutely. Aware of the suffering. He was aware of the injustice. Mm-hmm. And so for me, the gospel is being awake, being aware mm-hmm. of others, mm-hmm. to be sensitive to make certain that others have the basics, at least mm-hmm. have what they need. So mm-hmm. to me, the gospel is all about justice.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. It is very clear to me if I read the New Testament, which is, of course, the closest approximation to the actual words of Jesus that we have. Granted, there are all kinds of interpretive layers there, but it's clear to me that Jesus was a figure who interrupted a toxic narrative that was, you are not good enough unless you do these certain things to keep yourself pure. And that is how you will deserve God's grace. And he interrupted that to say, stop worrying about purity. Stop worrying about what makes you good enough. It's actually not about you. And in fact, if you follow me, you will see that we are going to go to the very places that will make you impure, because that is where love abounds. That is where you will find God. That is where truth prevails.
That the kingdom is laid out before you. It's here. It's now.
It's already here. It's already at hand if you will just wake up to it. And you will be the hands and feet of love in the world. You don't need to worry about becoming impure by eating with women or whatever it is that makes you impure. You need to love those who need it most. You need to offer the gifts that you have to help feed, literally in this world, feed and heal and teach and serve. Not so that you can deal with the afterlife and so that your own soul is preserved. Purity is done. We're done with that conversation.
Yeah.
It's about caring for each other.
You know, it is more blessed to mm-hmm. give than to receive. Mm-hmm. I've always thought about that. But when you actually go to a hospital to visit someone mm-hmm. who is deathly ill mm-hmm. Or who's terrified because they've mm-hmm. been diagnosed with cancer and they have to have surgery mm-hmm. and not aware of what their future holds, you're giving of yourself.
Absolutely.
So now this is different from charity.
Absolutely.
So charity is a little bit different from that of actual justice.
And I think that it points at the nature of the gospel as we are articulating it. It's that it's not about creating band-aids to place on a broken world that is incurable. It's about transforming this world and believing. That's what faith is, believing that we can. Not have a world that's broken and we can help people and feed the hungry, but that we can eliminate hunger, that we can create structures and communities and people, individuals who live so fervently for justice that we don't need charity, that our structures in place are those that God would say are good. Absolutely. It leads us into Marcus's next statement as we think about the movement toward this kind of just world and the changes that our own world is going through. Marcus's fourth statement on things that he does not believe.
A fifth thing I don't believe. Christianity is the only way of salvation. Now, like the other elements in my list, I can't believe that. It's not simply that I choose not to. You could promise me Bill Gates's billions if I would believe that, and I might say, I believe, but I wouldn't be able to. Put slightly differently, Christianity has no monopoly on God, and Christianity has no monopoly on goodness.
So Marcus says a very risky thing here, something that can catch people under fire in big ways, particularly politically, that Christians do not have the market cornered on salvation. And before I get into the wonderful content of that I absolutely resonate with, I love one of the little things he says, and it's that it was not a choice to believe this. I think that's one thing that is woven throughout his work that was incredibly liberating to me. I spent so much of my youth trying to pray away the questions, trying to change the nature of myself to not ask certain things, and that couldn't happen. And it wasn't until I encountered this kind of thinking that I realized I didn't make me this way. I didn't put these questions here. Perhaps that's exactly what God wants me to ask. Perhaps that's the road we need to be on. And I love that idea that so many things in the world that we profess are a choice are not a choice. And so if we are not choosing that, might it be worth our time to consider that that's what God intended?
Mm. Well, I want to pick up on that. Marcus, talking about Christianity not cornering the market on salvation, that, you know, I try to adhere to listen to form my life around the teachings of Jesus. But therefore, I find it impossible to believe that a God insists on everyone being Christian. It just seems literally to me, it seems to be un-Christian to believe that. I remember I, for the first time, I was a freshman in college, and I had across the hall from my dorm room were Jewish girls, and really it was my first time to spend time to live among people of the Jewish tradition, and being growing so close to the, those girls and becoming very, very good friends with them, it just never, after that, never made sense to me that God would be so cruel, so selfish, that these dear people, these kind people, would not also experience the kingdom.
Absolutely. I think, you know, as we raise these questions about the relevance of Marcus's comments from, you know, several years ago today, I think it's never been more crucial that we learn to engage other religions, particularly with what's happening politically in our world. I've spoken a lot this year, since January, on some panels and at workshops, and I spend a lot of time with some of my Muslim friends, and I have a number of Jewish friends that I'm close to here in Jackson. And one of the metaphors that I use when explaining how I operate with other religions is, again, I think a symptom of our culture. Our culture has decided to think about religions as though they are sports teams. So if my favorite team is Christians, if the Muslims start winning, that means the Christians are losing. And so I want to defeat the Muslims in this sports team.
That is great.
Which I think is a really terrible metaphor for religion. I think that and what
people can relate to that.
Absolutely.
And that is a great metaphor.
And so people who dwell in this world of athletics, and I have no opposition to it. I was raised in an incredibly athletic family, and I think sports have done wonderful things for social justice in our society as well. But if that is the lens through which you view religion, you have an incredibly limited understanding of religion. However, if we use a different metaphor, I think a more apt metaphor, and the one that I've often shared, is that I've heard people say that I'm spiritual but not religious.
I have too.
And I think that that's good and fine. However, I'm an extreme extrovert. And as an extrovert, I don't process things well individually. I, in fact, need a community of people around me to even understand what's happening. I need to verbally process. If religion is, in fact, a language and not a sports team, then it means that to be religious is to be spiritual among other people. And so I use that metaphor because Christianity is not my chosen team that I have an affinity toward. It is the spiritual language that I speak. It is the language I already speak to explore questions of great meaning, to inspire me to do good in the world, and to help me experience the divine. And so I speak English. It's my first language. However, I've learned other languages, and I know that English is not the only language. And in fact, there are whole concepts that English can't explore.
Right.
There are whole ideas that we don't have English words for. In particular, German is my second language. Words like Zeitgeist. Even in English, we use Zeitgeist because we don't have that word.
That's right.
There are imperfections in our language. That said, I continue to speak English because it is the language in which I am fluent. The same spiritually. I continue to speak Christian because it is my language. They are my stories. They are my songs. They are the language in which I am fluent. If I had been born Muslim, I would be fluent in Islam and I would use that language.
Right.
That said, it's incredibly valuable in learning other languages, in conversing with other people. And what we're starting to see in this globalized world that I think is incredibly beautiful, I'm seeing it among my undergrads, is spiritually bilingual people. Buddhist Christians,
yes,
Jewish
yes,
Muslims. It's absolutely, it helps bolster this idea of of religion, not as a sports team, but as a language that we can speak and use to be in community with one another.
It's a language that leads us through life.
Mm-hmm.
And what more enriching experience to be able to have mm-hmm. an opportunity to speak more than one language.
Absolutely.
You know, it's just clear that the Bible text, that there's no question about it. Jesus, of course, was a Jew.
Mm-hmm.
Period.
Yes.
And so, you know, going back to Marcus's original statement that Christianity, that mm-hmm. folks say that Christianity is the only way mm-hmm. To experience God or to reach mm-hmm. God or mm-hmm. to be embraced by God,
mm-hmm.
You know, even that alone, Jesus being Jewish, mm-hmm. do you think that God would, Jesus mm-hmm. would condemn mm-hmm. himself and his own people?
Yeah. I mean, it's a little bit of a tricky intellectual puzzle that you have to deal with.
I know people would just often think about this.
Absolutely.
You know, that passage absolutely mm-hmm. in John mm-hmm. makes no sense mm-hmm. if they are actually believing and worshiping in
right.
Jesus of Nazareth.
Right.
They're actually admitting that Jesus himself has condemned himself to be separated from God.
Absolutely.
It
yeah.
just makes
yeah,
it's a very, it's maybe folks will listen to this podcast and speak new languages and open
yes.
their hearts and
well,
minds
and
to other possibilities.
It's been one of the most enriching processes through which I've re-engaged my own faith. So, you know, this year I think I went to more iftar dinners, which is the in Ramadan, my Muslim friends fast all day, and then they prefer to break their fast in community and invite people over to these beautiful dinners. And we, you know, get the best of both worlds. We eat all day and then get to go have a feast they prepared for us all evening. But I have learned so much about hospitality and my own faith and what it means to love one's neighbor through my Muslim friends, especially when I visited Turkey a couple of years ago. And I just think for anyone who has the opportunity to get to know your neighbors of other faiths, it is one of the most rewarding and beautiful processes that I've been engaged in.
And when we do that, when people invite themselves to be open to that,
mm-hmm.
they actually find that we all speak so similar in our language, mm-hmm. in our history, even our passages
and even where there are differences, those differences make it all the richer and more beautiful.
Yeah.
They're not threatening or scary if this is a language, not a sports team.
I love that metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
Let's move into Marcus's fifth statement. And this is going to be the last statement that mm-hmm. we're going to share with folks today in this podcast. He's been talking before now about what he doesn't believe as a Christian. But this, he made several statements later on in his presentation about what he does believe as a Christian. So we're going to take one of those, and he speaks in a fifth statement. Let's just listen to it. Let's listen to what Marcus has to say about what he does believe about being Christian.
He may have been difficult to like. And I say that not out of any, disrespect or diminishment of him, but he was probably a bit too much. I'm thinking of his passion, the way he almost seemed to burn with fire. There is, of course, his compassion, but he did not suffer fools lightly. And so one of the reasons I'm still Christian is because of Jesus, but not because I think of him as this gentle Jesus, meek and mild, whom I'd like to have as my pool shooting buddy.
All right, Debo, so you have outlined Marcus's structure of this talk, right? He starts with things he doesn't believe. But one caveat, you say he follows up with things he does believe. And actually, I was paying really close attention to this, and that is a false binary. He actually does not come back in with what he does believe. He comes back in with what he does practice.
Yes.
And
yes.
I think that that distinction is really
good pick
key.
Up, man.
And I think I thought of this is that, you know, if I were in the dissertation process, this is probably what I would be writing on is this misinformed notion of what it is to be a Christian and this very modernist idea that we have that being a Christian is primarily about what you believe.
Mm-hmm.
But if you really look at the scriptures, and if you look at some of our most history-altering theologians, like Dietrich Bonhoeffer, you see they don't talk very much about what they believe. They talk about what we are to do. I am a Christian not because of what I believe, but because I follow the way of Jesus. I really don't care what I believe. Belief has very little to do with it for me. It is about how I move and have my being in the world. And so I think that that distinction, right, in addition to this comment that he made, and we'll return to the content of it, but he says, I'm still a Christian because I grew up Christian. I'm still a Christian because of the figure of Jesus. I'm still a Christian because of these traditions. He says things that he practices. And I think that that's a really valuable distinction, that belief is not necessarily the primary criterion for being a Christian. And if you look further into his writing or the writing of a little bit headier theologians like H. Cantwell Smith or Karen Armstrong does a beautiful exploration of his work, what belief actually means. And before the Enlightenment, belief was much more about action and setting one's heart to something than it was about giving intellectual assent.
Another one, In Search of Belief.
Absolutely.
That's a great book by mm-hmm. Sister Joan Chittister.
Absolutely.
That takes the Apostles' Creed mm-hmm. and moves through it just mm-hmm. beautifully. Mm-hmm. And so it's okay for people to have their beliefs.
Absolutely. We all do.
We all do.
In some very literal ones, I believe in gravity. I don't fear I'm going to fly up and run into the ceiling right now.
Yeah.
But I also believe that the arc of history bends toward justice, right? And that's a little bit harder to prove. We all have our beliefs. Beliefs are good. But being a Christian, in my estimation, is not as much about beliefs as about following.
And what we do, and Jesus provides for us, mm-hmm. And even, you know, it's not because I'm Christian, because you're Christian, mm-hmm. this is our language.
Right.
But even in the other traditions and their language, that those issues of justice, which we've already talked about earlier in the podcast, it seems to me that Jesus would simply be intolerant of a society of privilege.
Mm.
I think that Jesus, if Jesus came to my house for dinner
mm-hmm.
and people around the table mm-hmm. ask him what he really thought about religion and what he really thought about justice, mm-hmm. his words might not only make everybody very uncomfortable,
mm-hmm.
in fact, some of my guests might just stand up and throw their napkin down on the mm-hmm. table and say, I've had enough of this,
mm-hmm.
and just leave.
Absolutely.
So I think that Jesus would be intolerant of people having so much
mm-hmm.
while others go with practically nothing to sustain them.
Absolutely. I love the phrase he uses, and it really on a personal level resonated with me. Debo, you know that phrase would. When he says Jesus was a little bit too much, right? He's suggesting in this clip that Jesus may have been tough to hang out with. And Debo knows, you know, I've told this story to her before in my own personal narrative, struggling to find a faith community. And I have a dear friend who takes good care of me spiritually, who always checks in with me. And she said to me, you know, when was the last time you felt like you were enough? And I just laughed because I said to this friend, I think I've always felt like I was too much. It's not about not being enough. It's about feeling like my presence overwhelms many, many people who don't expect it, maybe, coming from the corner of the world that I come from, or being a woman, or not being ordained, or whatever the case may be. That sense of feeling too much. And that's what I love about what he says about Jesus. And that might be why, after all these years and all the wounds that the church can inflict on a person, I can't give up Jesus because he was too much.
Oh.
He, as Borg says, he's not meek and mild. That's not what's drawn him to Jesus. It's in fact this radical social justice activist who turns tables and is not afraid to speak down the powers that be and is not afraid of being impolite and is totally okay with people throwing their napkins down and walking out of the room, because that is how we will eventually overturn systems of injustice. Not just be nice to people and give canned goods to poor people, but overthrow systems that generate poverty entirely. And I love the too much Jesus. I sure don't want a meek and mild Jesus. I don't have time for that.
I think we've got t-shirts here. Jesus is too much.
Yes.
I think we're going to leave it with that and have people think about Jesus is just a little too much. Mm-hmm.
And the question that it begs, which is if we are not just believers in Jesus, but followers of Jesus, how are we called to be too much in the world? What difficult things are we called to say and do that may be unpopular? I do hope that today has given people an opportunity to glimpse into the life and work and legacy of Marcus Borg, who has been so incredibly formative for so many of us in our crucial educational years, in our own personal faith development. It's absolutely wonderful to revisit his work. And I hope that our listeners can find some of the liberation that I found in his embrace of his unbelief and his engagement with the radical Jesus.
Well, and we had originally talked about calling this episode Meeting Marcus Again for the First Time.
And I love it. And it felt that way. It's been so long since I read him. And I'm so far on the other side of a process that's always going to be ongoing. But, you know, having encountered him for the first time, while I was in a very literalist place, and encountering him again is a really beautiful moment.
Meet the Marcus Borg, the late, great Marcus Borg, again for the first time. If any of you out there have, if we've piqued your interest about Marcus Borg, or Dom Cross and Joan Chittister, those were other guests of this seminar. The seminar titled, Does Christianity Have a Future? It is available on USB drive or on DVD. Just please visit our website at faithandreason.org, faithandreason.org, where you can make a donation to support our programs. You can subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, visit our blog and video content, or find materials for you to use as individual study or group educational settings.
This program is produced by Faith and Reason, a program of the D.L. Dykes Jr. Foundation.